Hello, I'm Lina Ahmadou. Welcome to Health Chat. The Africa Cup of Nations just concluded in Abidjan, Côte d'Ivoire, and it was a time for football players to show strength, determination, and resilience. Experts say in high-performance sports, athletes' health and wellness refers to a condition of ideal physical, mental, and social well-being associated with an athlete's sporting achievement. Often viewed as models of physical strength, athletes must be in good health to compete, overcome difficulties, and achieve their goals. And adequate preparations and the prevention of injuries are some of the key factors that determine an athlete's success or failure. Reporter Annette Mugabo reports from Abidjan how athletes maintain their well-being.
Athletes face the pressure and challenges both on and off the field, and experts say preparation is a key. Amanda Dumming is the former captain of South Africa Women's Football National Team, also known as Banyana Banyana. She made a history as the first female commentator in the Africa Cup of Nations. She discussed what she used to do to maintain her well-being during her days as a player.
Key aspects of this, maybe a diet, a proper diet is very important. A proper training routine is also quite important. And I think maybe a consistent drive and focus to a particular goal. I think you will know how far to train if it is that you're focusing on one particular goal. It's a tough one because sometimes your body can give up because of fatigue, and sometimes your mental as well can really get into fatigue. So it's important. We spoke about the diet, what it is that you eat, the kind of training that you have. I think it contributes to that equal balance of physical and mental.
Sports coaches play a big role in the well-being of players, both mentally and physically. They must guide the athletes to stay health focused and motivate them to work hard and win. T. Olivier is a technical director of the International Basketball Federation.
Great athletes always make sacrifices. They must eat well and eat healthy. They must rest, sleep well, and also exercise well. As a matter of fact, I cannot overemphasize the importance of a great lifestyle in the success or failure of an athlete. The role of a coach is also important. The coach is the guide. They push the athletes far with the ideal or right programs. Rest, sleep, and recovery are important.
Dr. Ule Octave is a physician at National Institute of Youth and Sports and president of the Medical Council of FIBA Africa. He says a lot is involved in the well-being of athletes, and there can be a difference to some extent depending on gender and age.
Et donc la médecine du sport.
The emergence of sports medicine and science has greatly helped in the prevention of injuries. Good sports equipment, kits, good shoes, for instance, will always help prevent some injuries from happening. Training methods also prevent injuries. One cannot train kids and adults in the same way. It is important for athletes to have the right kind of nutrition. The medical staff, comprising doctors, physios, dietitians, psychologists, etc., play a big role in the prevention of injuries. Injuries can be physical or even psychological. The anatomy of a man is very different from that of a woman. We are talking about muscle mass and structure. Men and women take part in the same or similar sports, but the training can be very different.
During AFCON in Abidjan, VOA's Alvaro Andrade caught up with Dr. Nuno Duarte Martins, a surgeon specialized in sports medicine and medical doctor for the Cape Verde national team. He elaborated on what it takes for athletes to stay healthy and prepare for the games.
On the prevention side, we learn practices. As the name say, to prevent injuries such as precautions, athletes must take in trainings and games with food, including the liquids they drink, the drinks we give them. And then we have diseases which are related to the weather. the existence of typical conditions in a region like here. This region has a risk of yellow fever, so there's the need for vaccination. There's malaria as well, so we prevent by administering preventative medication weekly. In a competition like this, in a place with high temperatures and high humidity, we have lesions that are related to dehydration, a condition that can be very severe. We try to choose the best equipment for each weather condition. We also do the supplements to boost their immune system, to avoid situations like that, but also the preventative medication. They can't lose more than 2% of their body weight per day, or they risk not being able to participate in a high-level sports competition, such as soccer in this case. Evaluating the clinical condition of the athlete to take the necessary measures right in the field, during the game, or during the training, so we can have the diagnosis promptly, or through complementing imaging methods. We act accordingly to each situation, and we follow the protocols from the International Olympic Committee. They also make us think about the more frequent injuries, such as concussions, brain traumas, contact trauma that can cause fractures, lesions in tendons and muscles. And I also think about the list of medications that I need to have available and the clinical staff I need to travel with, so we're well equipped to do this fundamental part, which is the recovery of injuries, but also the prevention of them. A high-level team must be accompanied by several healthcare professionals. It starts with the doctor, who leads the clinical staff, the physiotherapist, and in our case, we are very well taken care of in terms of physiotherapists. We also have a good masseuse, a chef. We can mention other professionals, such as psychologists, who can be available in person in many situations.
That was Dr. Nuno Duarte Martins, the medical doctor for the Cape Verde national team. A 20-year-old Zimbabwean with cerebral palsy is hoping to compete in the 2024 Special Olympics Canada Winter Games in Calgary from February 27th to March 2nd. Meanwhile, groups that advocate for disabled people's rights are hoping to turn government policy into law. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, Zimbabwe.
In Ufakose Township in Harare, Zimbabwe, Tapiwa Nashe, Prince Mutsikira, spends his time running and training students at his former school, some of whom have disabilities. Mutsikira, a 22-year-old runner with cerebral palsy, hopes his hard work will help him qualify to represent Zimbabwe in track competitions at the 2024 Special Olympics Canada Winter Games in Calgary from February 27 to March 2. In the coming days, he will take part in Special Olympics training to test his athletic abilities for participation in the games. He says he will be excited to get a chance to compete at the Olympics. He tells his colleagues that they can do the same, that with their disabilities, they can also compete and they should not look down on themselves. He maintains a positive outlook despite having cerebral palsy, a group of disorders that affect a person's ability to move and maintain balance and posture. His grandmother, Tambuzai Rujizonyariri, who began caring for Mutsikiram when he was 3, says at one point she could not imagine her grandson training and competing like this. She says the family has since learned that her grandson does a lot of stuff, and they thank God for his positive attitude toward life. He is only 22 and is training other children living with disabilities. It's unbelievable. Zimbabwe statistics say that of its population of 16 million people, more than 1.4 million have a disability. Now organizations of people with disabilities in Zimbabwe are pushing for the passage of legislation that would make law some recommendations based on the government's disability policy launched in 2021. Advocates say the current law, the Disabled Persons Act of 1992, is falling short. Peter Barre heads Sight Savers, an advocacy group for disabled people.
If the bill is passed into law, it means so many other services that they are not accessing at the moment will be accessible. Because at the moment, our current act at the moment is outdated.
Zimbabwe's policy says disabled people should have equal rights to employment, education, and health, among other things. Government officials say some provisions of the National Disability Policy are being implemented. Christine Peter is Director of Disability Affairs in Zimbabwe's Ministry of Public Service, Labour and Social Welfare.
The government of Zimbabwe has now set up a national technical committee on disability inclusion. This committee has representatives from all the 26 government ministries. It has representatives from organizations of persons with disabilities and our development partners as well.
Meanwhile, Mutsikira says he will keep pushing ahead and encouraging other persons with disabilities to do the same. Columbus Mavungam, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
We asked how the psychological state of athletes affect their physical performance. Here is what some athletes in Abidjan had to say.
An athlete must have a very strong mind, a mind of steel. For example, when I have a competition, I already prepare myself mentally and psychologically. Why? Because I say to myself, given all the time it takes for preparation, like 4 years for Olympic Games and Paralympic Games, will I squander everything in a matter of seconds? No. So I build myself mentally. The greatest athletes who have reached the highest level in their career are really strong mentally. So it is necessary to train your mind to always be able to surpass oneself, whether it is in training and especially in competition. It's not just about the physical. Certainly, we work on everything you can be physically ready. And if you don't have mental strength to manage your stress during the big competitions, it is as if you haven't done anything, actually. An athlete without mental strength is like an athlete without motivation. You work on your mind. You do that gradually through training, gradually through competitions. You build a mind of steel. So I believe that the mind is an integral part of sports. It is a performance factor for athletes.
In cases like football, for example, there are teams that when they concede a goal, they are morally down. There have been cases like that. You have to give yourself another mindset to bounce back. For me, the mind is a very important thing that I have to work on a lot. I feel a great relief when I do mental preparation before doing any activity.
James Wood is a former soccer player in the Malawi national team and a partner and director with the sports company Rainbow Sports Global. I asked him his thoughts on how an athlete's mind affects his or her physical performance.
You know, first of all, to kick off with being called up to the Malawi national team, that was a very big honor for me. That was in preparations of the 2010 Africa Cup of Nations. So I joined the squad in camp in Denmark. So it was a great experience. But tying into the question you've asked, you know, I'll reflect on it, on my personal experiences and to what I work in today. So you can think of the mind and body like friends on the soccer field. You need the mind and the body to interact. When I was playing, I learned that what I wanted my legs to do needed my mind as well. I couldn't just do it. I needed to have the right focus, the right mentality, the right training to be able to enact what I want to carry out on the pitch. And I learned from my mistakes that I wasn't that prepared whilst others were prepared. But I, you know, being in that setting of being in Denmark, we saw that our European counterparts were very equipped, were ready psychologically, mentally, and physically. Whilst on our side, we were lacking quite a bit. And I think it was that realization from that time that the mind and body play a very, very close link together, because the brain itself signals to our body that we have to pump up or slow down. We have to know that with the right nutrition, the right food, the right mentality, this is what helps us actually become elite athletes. And I think that element itself is something we really need to delve into a bit more, more so on the African continent. I think technology is advancing at a fast rate, and we need to understand how we can interlock those two to play a vital role because they are one unit.
How does the mind affect an athlete's performance, whether it is positively or negatively?
Well, I think AFCON itself, to be honest with you, this has been a great tournament. And on that basis itself, I said to myself, actually, you know, the Ivory Coast is a great example of this. In the group stages of the tournament, manager got fired, as you're well aware. The team, the players had to pick themselves up. And if you look at the way Ivory Coast have performed, they have won games in the last minute. Let's just take an example of the game against Mali. The game against Mali, 10 men down. The focus of the athletes for the Ivory Coast was that mentality that did not give up. They went 1-0 down. Everybody had written them off that this team is out. But the mentality, these are winners. These players are vying for their lives. They're looking at this as an opportunity to get the career, the contract of their lifetime for them. They're looking at this tournament. They don't want to disappoint the nation as well. They fought tooth and nail until the 90th minute, got that equalizing goal. We saw the Mali national team, probably a little bit overconfident, switch off a bit, which Ivory Coast captured that in the 9 minutes of extra time to win the game 2-1. Another example, I've seen a player sort of switch off. If we look at the game, this was South Africa versus Cape Verde. Cape Verde had the player Bebe who came on. And Bebe's mentality in the game, I think the pressure had actually hit him extremely hard because when his teammates were opening up in spaces, he wasn't looking. He was just looking one way, where's the goal? Even though he wasn't in the position to take a shot, even though he was in a better position to play a pass to somebody else, he let that pressure succumb and put all the weight on himself and started making the wrong decisions for his country, which eventually cost Cape Verde that game. So you can see the two dynamics. And another one that I think really stood out for me was how sometimes you as a player can switch off, but you need your teammates to really help you recover. And we saw that when Morocco were playing against South Africa, when Hashimi missed the penalty, he was down and he was trodden, he was out. His teammates rushed to him, picked him up, brushed him off. Let's get on. We need to win this game. You know, unfortunately, they didn't win, but you could see how having a close knit of players, teammates, where you fight for one another, work for one another, helps that mental state because it relieves the pressure on you. You're in very high tense situations. You've got thousands of fans watching you in the stadium. You've got millions elsewhere watching on television. You've got family members looking at you. That pressure is extremely high. So at that point, you need to have yourself, you need to prepare yourself mentally that you're a champion. You're in battle. There's only one outcome. You need to win. Results not always go your way, but you have to put in that effort. And that team needs to come together as a unit to really help the players and to get out of that.
And speaking of training, training of the mind, how can athletes train their mind to achieve peak performance? And what is the role of their management team in the process?
Training the mind is like going to the gym for your thoughts, to put in that context. Now, you need to coach players in a way whereby they have to imagine winning. They have to imagine what it is to win. They have to set goals. They have to believe in themselves. Now, this is easier when you start that at a younger age in athletes. It's a little bit harder. The older we get more stuck in our own ways. So this is why grassroots football is extremely important, or grassroots sports in essence, be it basketball, hockey, netball. You have to start at a very young age where you're training the mentality. That mentality itself, you put that into practice. You guide athletes. You nurture them. You guide them. You help them through the trials and tribulations. You have to let them know how to deal with the pressures of modern day sport. Modern day sport is extremely competitive. One mistake could be the end of your career, or one good opportunity could be the beginning of your career. So to have that right mental state that if you have a breakdown at any point, you can recover very quickly to regain your composure. Now, ourselves, like what we do, this is with Rainbow Sports Global, we start learning, we start teaching these young athletes from a very young age, because at that point, they're quite malleable. They absorb the training methods. They absorb how to handle themselves. But it's always a challenge. It's not a one-fit-all solution. So it's an ongoing process. So from a young age, you maintain it, because the older you get, the more successful you become, the higher the pressures, the higher the stakes.
That was James Wood, partner and director with the sports company Rainbow Sports Global. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. Brazil has launched a public vaccination campaign against dengue fever amid a surge of cases nationwide. According to the country's health ministry, Brazil has seen nearly five times more cases in the first 5 weeks of this year than in the same period in 2023. From Sao Paulo, Juan Bouchard has the story.
Facing its largest dengue fever epidemic in decades, Brazil is starting a mass vaccination program against the tropical disease through its public immunization system. According to health ministry officials, this year, Brazil aims to vaccinate around 3 million people. The nationwide vaccination campaign starts this month as the country sees a surge of cases. According to data from the Ministry of Health, Brazil has recorded more than 360,000 dengue cases in the first weeks of 2024, nearly a five-fold increase over the same period last year.
Here in my house, there were four cases. My brother had it, and my friend had it, who are my neighbors. In my family, five people had it.
In this street in a working-class neighborhood of São Paulo, almost all residents were infected with the disease. Health agents are touring the region to eliminate mosquito breeding sites, but it's not easy.
The country has been experiencing heat waves since late 2023, and now with the sequences of rain, it ends up having the perfect situation for the mosquito to proliferate.
The surge in dengue cases is not exclusive to Brazil. Data from the World Health Organization shows that the disease is spreading to areas where it was not previously found, such as many subtropical regions of the planet. According to the WHO, there was a tenfold increase in the number of cases worldwide from 2000 to 2019. Esper Calas heads Butantan Institute, a biomedical research center in São Paulo.
Global warming, as you said, is one of the things that concerns a lot of people. I mean, having the temperature going up, it makes more, easy for the mosquito to reproduce and spread, and therefore serve as a transmitter.
Calas is leading a team of Brazilian scientists who are finalizing the last tests to develop their own vaccine. They estimate that their vaccine will be in production by next year.
So we hope to have everything in place for 2025. And then we can start making the vaccine available to the health authorities.
While the vaccine supply remains limited, this year the Brazilian government will focus on immunizing children ages 10 to 14 in 500 cities across 16 states. Yabuesha, VOA News, São Paulo, Brazil.
In South Sudan, where conflict, climate change, and economic challenges converge, the situation for children is dire. Severe malnutrition, lack of access to food, and limited resources for healthcare pose significant risks to their well-being and prospects. NewsHour's Fred de Sam Lazaro has this report from South Sudan, where nearly two-thirds of the population face acute hunger.
By many measures, South Sudan is one of the worst places on earth to be a child. Vivid reminders of this greet workers who actually measure the fragile arms at this nutrition center in the capital, Juba. Almost every infant checks in the red zone, severely malnourished. On the day we visited, Christine Dier brought in her two-year-old daughter, Esther, a two-year-old who weighs 11 pounds, she says. That's less than half the normal weight range for her age.
There was no food for us in the house, so this child got anemic, and they told me that she was malnourished.
Jacqueline Marco was here with her eight-month-old, Rose Jima.
I'm breastfeeding, but there's not enough milk. Sometimes the whole week there's no food. We have to go to the neighbors and ask for food.
Does she know how much Rose Jima weighs? Two kilos, so that's 4.5 pounds for an eight-month-old child.
It's very likely she weighed more than that as a newborn.
Malnutrition, especially at such a young age, especially under 2 years of age, has significant cognitive challenges. Neurological development, cognitive development, and all is affected.
Dr. Mesfin Loha is the country director for World Vision, a large Christian charity that contracts with the United Nations to deliver services here.
So the future of South Sudan in so many ways is quite literally shriveling away.
Without urgent support to turn the tide of this devastation, it is going to be a big problem.
The children's struggle could be a metaphor for their young country. Born a decade ago after a long separatist war, South Sudan has been battered by unrelenting civil conflict. More than 2 million of its citizens remain refugees in neighboring countries, and a similar number have been driven into crowded camps, overwhelming those trying to provide assistance.
The supply of basic foodstuffs has dwindled in warehouses like these as the UN's World Food Program has run out of money to restock them. And the WFP has had to reprioritize, as one official put it, taking away food from the hungry to feed the starving.
There's nothing as difficult as trying to convince someone who is hungry that there's someone who is hungrier, that you need to prioritize someone else.
Sibona Kaliso Impala is with World Vision's facilities in the northern town of Malakal, a region where the small farmers have seen their livelihoods devastated by erratic weather in recent months. All around the soggy camp, the land remains waterlogged, and many people fear there's a lot more rain on the way.
We're seeing the effects of climate change right at the front, because we do have cyclic drought, and then more recently we've been seeing worsening flooding. Both effects really affect the abilities of the communities to cope. They cannot cultivate.
So instead of scaling up, you're actually scaling down?
We're scaling down.
Across the country, internal refugees like Nyaluak Guy, who heads a household of 7 children, have been forced to live with less, much less. When we visited early this August, she showed us her monthly rations. Sorghum, already half gone. Cooking oil, fast running out. And some beans, all gone. And a lot of August still to go.
This is sufficient for one meal a day for 10 days. So what do you do for the rest of the time?
Whenever this runs out, we go to the bush to look for wild fruits or bring in firewood for sale, and we can use that little money we get from selling firewood to buy other food in the market.
Rounding up the perfect storm with conflict and climate change, the war in Ukraine. It sent prices soaring for fertilizer, fuel, and food, hitting big buyers like the World Food Program and small ones like Jane Kiden, who have beaten the odds and eked out a life outside of camps.
Now in the market, things are very expensive, and I cannot afford to buy food for my children.
She belongs to a group that tends a community garden, one way to cope with the scarcity. A single mother of 8, Jane Kiden also does domestic work around town when she can find it. We visited early the next morning as she prepared a pot of porridge made from fermented sorghum. It's rich in carbohydrates and protein, but there's just 1 cup per child to last the whole day, or if she doesn't find work, until the next morning. Another lost dream, Jane was forced to pull out 3 of her 6 school-aged children.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lina Humudu, in Washington, with producer Kwame Ofori. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.